Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Somewhere, just outside the focus of your conscious mind, you have always known that this show is a member of the Agora Podcast Network, a collective of podcasts that exist outside of the tradition of criticism. This month we are promoting the various shows produced by friend of the show, Travis Dow, under the Podcastnik moniker. I think most appropriate for this group is the History of Germany podcast, though I've been a fan of all of Travis' shows for many's the year. To learn more about Podcastnik or any of the other great shows on Agora, check out agorapodcastnetwork.com. This month's show is also brought to you by the History of Vikings podcast, a show that delves into various topics in the exciting history of the Vikings, a people who have come in and out of this show and who have captured the European imagination for centuries. To learn more about the History of Vikings podcast, visit thehistoryofvikings.com. This month's show is also brought to you by OnlineGreatBooks.com. Now, I have always been a voracious reader, but these days, between a full-time job, the podcast, a toddler, and the siren call of social media, I sometimes have trouble keeping up with the reading I have to do for the show, let alone pursuing loftier goals like developing my knowledge of great books or self-improvement. OnlineGreatBooks.com is designed to help you develop a regular habit of reading the great books. Weekly reading goals, reading reminders, accountability tools, and a dedicated community of fellow readers help keep you on track and on schedule with your reading. The online greatbooks.com check-in and reading goal system is designed to help you progress through the great books with just 3 one-hour reading sessions each week. Every month, onlinegreatbooks.com ships a carefully selected edition of one of the great books directly to your home. And we begin with Homer and progress through works by Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, Shakespeare, and the moderns. Each month, you'll meet in a 2-hour video conference to discuss your text with a small community of readers in a Socratic seminar led by a trained Socratic host. Go to OnlineGreatBooks.com to join the VIP list and receive an executive book summary, a digest of the reading list, and more. If you're interested in developing a lifelong habit of reading and studying the great books, go to OnlineGreatBooks.com and enter the promo code WIT, W-I-T, to get 25% off your first 3 months. As a bonus, I'll get a little something from it. Okay, have the suits gone? Alright, this month's show is really brought to you by you guys. Or at least, some of you guys. Sure, the ad revenue helps, but the lights are kept on and the sources are really purchased by the money I get from my glorious patrons and my magnificent donors. Our first patron, worthy of honor and praise, shall be known henceforward as Dylan, the Knight of 1,000 Muffins. Next is patron Tim, who shall be known henceforward as Sir Tim, Actuary at Arms. And finally, we have donor Michael, who shall be known henceforward as Michael,
Thatch Knight.
If you would like to join the serried ranks of our donors and patrons, head on over to the website. If you go to the store page, there are links and buttons that'll get you to our Patreon page, or to allow you to make a secure donation on PayPal. Both are wonderful, and both theoretically come with swag, though I haven't sent that out in a while. Sorry. And, of course, thank you so, so much to all of our patrons and donors, past and present, and to all of you for listening. If you don't feel up to donating at this time in a monetary fashion, then consider going to iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice and leaving a 5-star written review. Thank you very much. Hello, all. Today's episode is going to be a discussion about Pope Gregory I with Steve Guerra from the History of Papacy podcast. I'll get into it a little bit more in the actual body of the show, but as you'll have noticed, it's a fairly long show. So I am splitting it in two. I'm just not putting it in two episodes for everyone's convenience. But I know a lot of you don't like particularly long shows, so for the sake of those who are so inclined, I have inserted an intermission at a rough halfway point in the show. So fear not, your needs have been seen to. And now, let us get to the show.
Since, then, we have shown what manner of man the pastor ought to be, let us now set forth after what manner he should teach. For, as long before us, Gregory Nazianzen, of reverend memory, has taught. One and the same exhortation does not suit all, inasmuch as all are not bound together by similarity of character. For the things that profit some often hurt others. Seeing that also, for the most part, herbs which nourish some animals are fatal to others, and the gentle hissing that quiets horses incites whelps, and the medicine which abates one disease aggravates another, and the food which invigorates the life of the strong kills little children. Therefore, according to the quality of the hearers, ought the discourse of teachers to be fashioned, so as to suit all and each for their several needs, and yet never deviate from the art of common edification. For what are the intent minds of hearers but, so to speak, a kind of harp, which the skillful player, in order to produce a tune possessing harmony, strikes in various ways? And for this reason the strings render back a melodious sound, because they are struck indeed with one quill, but not with one kind of stroke. Whence every teacher also, that he may edify all in the one virtue of charity, ought to touch the hearts of his hearers out of one doctrine, but not with one and the same exhortation. Quote from the Book of Pastoral Rule by Pope Gregory I.
Quote read by James Early from the Presidential Fight Club podcast and the American History Fanatics Facebook page. Check him out.
Everyone's right and no one is sorry. That's the start and the end of the story. From the sharks and the jets to the call in the morning.
Greetings! My name is Benjamin Jacobs, and this is episode 44, A Tale of Two Gregories, Part 1. Gregory the Great with Steve Guerra of the History of the Papacy podcast. We are approaching a milestone in our discussion of the Middle Ages. The years between 1000 and 1300 set in motion massive changes in European society that would have a major impact on the early modern period, aka the point of this show. Many historians now argue that the modern period actually began in 1300. The reforms of the papacy, starting with Gregory VII, that I referenced last episode, were pivotal to that change, but they did not come out of nowhere. Now, I think I've done a decent job in the last two episodes in sort of setting the stage in terms of the organized shape of the church, and in the many episodes before that of setting the stage for Europe in general, but I've left out a lot of the nitty-gritty details of the specific actions taken by the popes as individuals. For the most part, this was a choice made in the interest of time, because there are other better podcasts that will be covering these topics, for example, the History of the Papacy with Steve Guerra. I also made this choice because most of the popes in our timeline have been fairly generic, and I'm also sort of a person with a bias towards social history rather than focusing on the actions of great men, you may have noticed. But in doing things this way, I have to admit a mea culpa, and I skipped over Gregory the Great, aka Gregory the First. I thought I could get away with it. He didn't seem all that pertinent to the early modern period, but all my sources talk about him in length, and so here we are. I clearly screwed up in skipping him. I didn't want to do it, but I have to. Given my reluctance and unfamiliarity, I thought it would be useful to bring in an outside expert to help us get through this. And so we are joined today by Steve Guerra, the creator and talent behind the excellent History of the Papacy podcast, a fellow member of the Agora podcast network, a friend of the show, and a fan of fine craft beers. Steve, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's, I love talking about Gregory, so this is awesome.
it's of course, wonderful to have you.
As we start up on this discussion of Gregory the Great, I should help position us a little bit in who we are talking about. I referenced a Pope Gregory in the last episode. As I said before, that is Gregory the Seventh. There have actually been 16 Catholic popes named Gregory and 2 anti-popes. This one that we're going to be talking about today is Pope Gregory the First. Gregory is a towering figure in the history of Catholicism in Europe. His papacy began in 590, and he's one of only 2 popes to be called the Great. I think one of the big things that we're going to be talking about today is how we feel about that. But let's start by getting through some background and some biographical materials. Gregory was born roughly 540. We'll talk about that. But in the background of the migration period, the rough part of European history, the early Middle Ages, when the empire was falling apart. And in particular, in the context of the Italian wars and the plagues of Justinian. Steve, do you want to give us a little bit of background about the context that Gregory came into?
So Gregory was born, like you said, in about 540. They don't have a record for that, which is interesting. But that's right around the end. I'm not as familiar with the Italian wars, but that's kind of in the middle-ish of the Byzantine period where they were attacking in the wars of Justinian. That was a really interesting time because a lot of scholars say that really was the end of the Western Roman Empire, not as much 476. Things pretty much carried over the institutions of the Roman Empire under the Goths, but maybe not all of the pomp and circumstance of an emperor, but the socially speaking and governmentally speaking. But when Justinian came in and conquered Italy, that's when the floor really fell out from the Western Roman Empire, especially in Italy. Like you said, there was the plague of Justinian, where a lot of people died. There was a climate change where a lot of people died. There was crop failures where a lot of people died. And for me, I know a lot of people don't like the term Dark Ages, but I'd have to say, like, if you were an Italian who was born in the early 500s and was lucky enough to live into the mid 500s, it was probably looked pretty dark to you.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I've certainly tried to avoid that term in my show, but I agree that, you know, in terms of a lack of written material and the archaeological evidence of like people living in these hollowed out cities, it seems as much like an apocalypse as anything we can conceive of.
Yeah, like a bad post-apocalyptic novel when you're looking at Rome that had maybe 100,000 people or less, but then it's down to 10, 30,000 people within a few decades.
Yeah. You know, people farming, people grazing cattle on the forum and stuff like that. And that's, you know, attested in the archaeology, not just the written sources. Yeah, Justinian pretty much was still working in that old Roman Empire fashion of making a desert and calling it peace, except that he didn't get the chance to like rebuild things afterwards and make a new Pax Romana because, you know, unbeknownst to him and his generals, his conquest of Italy was immediately followed by the plague of Justinian and then the Persian Wars and eventually the rise of Islam. And ultimately that was sort of the high point of the reassertion of the Byzantine Empire. And it really left Italy an absolute mess. You know, they were, he sent in too small a force. They didn't have enough to just conquer everything outright. So it became a series of running battles, lots of sieges, which are always super destructive. And then of course the plague and the climate change was probably more of a long-term thing. We discussed in my episodes on Italy, the deforestation of central and southern Italy, creating real problems. So anyway, I think that's enough on the background of Italy in general. What was the place of the papacy within all this? How firmly, how coherent was the church at this point?
I put in a lot of notes here, so you can shut me down whenever you want. But I think it's kind of interesting that these were the power of the papacy. You kind of have to completely forget everything you know about the papacy, because it really didn't exist at this point. The Pope was titularly the head of the Western Church. The Patriarchate of Rome had the largest area geographically. Now, I use that term patriarchate. There was five patriarchates, or like head bishops in Christendom at that time. There was Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. You can kind of throw in there, but that was more of a bonus prize that they gave to Jerusalem. The real powerful ones were Constantinople, Alexandria, and Antioch. And Rome had the largest geographical territory. It was everything in Western Europe, the Balkans and Greece, along with the western section of North Africa, like basically everything east or west, rather, of modern day Libya. So that's a huge territory, and it was a fairly diverse territory, probably less diverse than you would imagine it today, but still very diverse. Less diverse than today, but still fairly diverse.
What kind of actual control did Rome actually have over, you know, it was basically the only patriarchate of the entire Latin West. How much control did they have?
You have to political power, basically none. They had some influence, but politically almost none. Theologically, in theory, they had control over these areas, but from each area geographically, it was more or less. The Pope was pretty powerful in central Italy, Sicily, and southern Italy. But if you take a look at a place like northern Africa, there was a splinter group called the Donatists that had started in about during the time of Diocletian in the 300s, late 200s, early 300s, that was still powerful and growing more powerful. And they were a splinter group where the Pope had very little control over them. You had just to the east of the Italian peninsula in Greece and the Balkans, where they used their position in between Constantinople and Rome to basically do whatever they wanted to. And culturally, they were more connected to Constantinople. So anything that the Pope said that they didn't like, they would just ignore and look to Constantinople. So that was a constant clash. An interesting one that'll come up as we talk more is in Britain. And Britain, traditionally, people think, well, that's after the Anglo-Saxons came, it was pagan. But more modern archaeology and genetic study shows that a lot of the Celtic population was still there, and there was probably a lot more Christianity there. It just wasn't very well organized.
Yeah.
And then the urban areas of Gaul and modern day France, especially in southern France, like Arles, they were trying to exert independence over the papacy, and the papacy over the course of the few decades prior to Gregory would have more or less success of trying to rein them in. Certain sees wanted to be more independent or less, and that was a constant struggle for the papacy.
Yeah, I know there was always one city or another that was trying to get the Frankish emperors to make them patriarchs to raise them to the patriarchate. And it was always like just one early death away from happening.
Then you have Spain, which was officially run by Arians, but it did have a significant Catholic population as well. So you had Arians actually in North Africa and in Spain, which makes things very interesting, because that's another, at least the Donatists, they were elite. They were mostly on the same page as the Catholics, where the Arians were on an entirely different page.
Right.
So you have that as well, where the popes had zero control over them or influence over them. During Gregory's reign, the king of the Visigoths in Spain did convert to Catholicism, which then, you know, the it became that became more popular amongst the ruling nobility. Gregory didn't have a whole lot to do. I think that was forces that were well on the way before Gregory hit the scene that they were going to become Catholic.
Yeah, sure.
But so, I mean, it was really splintered, the whole that whole patriarchate.
I mean, it's not like the Pope had any control over the selection of bishops or anything. Those are all elected, basically, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that's a good background to just get us started. What do we know about Gregory's early life?
He was from a senatorial family, a wealthy family, but that was also really steeped in Christianity. He had two or three aunts who were already nuns, two papal ancestors, Pope Felix III in the late 400s, and then this name is so hard, Agapetus, who was a not a direct relative, I think he was, but and his papacy was a few decades before, but he was in that family. So it's
right.
And that was pretty common at the times. The aristocracy was growing into the church at this time.
Right. It was the only way to exert any kind of, it was the only form of political organization that Italy really had at that point. So,
and he, Gregory received the best education possible in Rome, but that education might not have been to the quality that was possible just a few decades previous to that.
Yeah.
And a lot of scholars even question what level of proficiency Gregory had in Greek. He probably spoke it, and given what he, some of the things he did in his later life, it's kind of hard to believe that he didn't at least speak Greek. But his knowledge of academic and high arts Greek was probably not where it would have been earlier in the 6th century.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know from my reading that there were like a bunch of Greek monasteries scattered around Rome, which is something that I've always been fascinated by and haven't had the opportunity to go down that rabbit hole in my own research. But it does make sense that, you know, actually getting an education in Greek wouldn't necessarily have been super possible given the time period. But speaking of monasteries, how did Gregory enter the church?
He became a monk, and that's what his true love was. You see that in every source. That's all he really wanted to be, was a monastic.
Mm-hmm.
But he started several monasteries throughout Italy, and that sort of foreshadows his ability as an organizer. After that, he was called up because he was educated and he was from the right family. His father held a secular post in the Roman government. And I think he was a senator or something for what the Senate was worth at that time.
Sure.
But that made Gregory a prime candidate to be a papal representative. Nowadays, they call them nuncios. They had a Greek name for that back then, but it's basically it's a ambassador of the Pope to the emperor in Constantinople.
Right. Just to double back to the monasticism, I read briefly that he had actually turned, like after his father died, he turned his father's estate into a monastery, which I thought that was an interesting story.
Yeah, their mansion on the Caelian Hill in Rome, he turned into a monastery, St. Andrew's, I believe it was called.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just thought that was interesting. So, papal politics at this time is fascinating, and I've been fighting to avoid running down that rabbit hole with the show and doing another Gadeshi kind of series. But so how did Gregory become Pope? Because it's odd that someone who's so free from scandal essentially ended up becoming Pope at that time.
The story, at least, is that everybody came together and saw that he was, well, he was in Constantinople. We should probably say that from 579 sure. to 586. And he had a hit or miss relationship with the, he got along well with the emperor, but he clashed with the patriarch of Constantinople, who was starting at that time to be called the ecumenical patriarch, which meant like worldwide patriarch. And that was a sticking point. It sounds like a silly sticking point, but there was a whole history of Constantinople. Constantinople wasn't a patriarchate until Constantine made Constantinople a patriarchate.
Right.
And then slowly Constantinople went from, it wasn't a patriarchate, it became a patriarchate. Then they said, oh, it's only second to Rome. And then another council made it, well, it's not quite second to Rome. It's like Rome's little brother, but his Rome's better little brother. And the popes were never okay with that.
Right. And to be fair, that's not pure ego. There was a certain amount of sort of the way that these things were supposed to be justified was you're supposed to have an apostle that founded your city, and you know, Rome had two.
Yeah.
And who knew what Byzantium was at the time that that the apostles were around? But anyway.
And another little factoid that I thought was interesting, and you get it a little bit, you get a better view of Constantinople's and the patriarch of Constantinople's perspective, is that the title ecumenical was added to all of the emperor's main advisors. And it was sort of just to say, like, the Eastern Roman Empire is the center of the world, and the ecumenical garbage collector was like the garbage collector. So it's kind of, you can see why somebody would take it the wrong way, but you could also see, well, maybe they're just making a mountain out of a molehill with that title.
Right. Yeah.
Gregory is acclaimed and elected Pope, but he was still just a junior deacon. He wasn't even a priest at that point, which wasn't entirely unusual. It was unusual in the fact that Gregory was young to be elected Pope and relatively green.
Yeah, one thing I've noticed, and this is sort of an interesting, this is a total aside, it's an interesting parallel with Venetian politics. When things got really contentious in Rome, they would always go for these, like, septuagenarians or octogenarians, which in the Middle Ages, that was just, like, punting, because, you know, they're only going to live for a year or two. But that was like a feature of the Venetian system. It's like, we always pick someone who's over 60 because, you know, no matter how bad they are, we know they're going to die in a couple of years.
It's interesting with Gregory that at this point he petitioned the Roman emperor, the Eastern Roman emperor Maurice, to not accept his election as papacy. So at that point, the Byzantine emperor had to stamp at least officially that he was allowing someone to become the papacy, which I think standing in modern times, looking back, you'd be like, why would the Eastern Roman emperor have to put a stamp on who was becoming Pope? And that fits the papacy into this bigger time period called the Byzantine papacy.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the whole Eastern Empire was much, you know, the term Kaiseropapism comes from the Eastern Empire and the ancient, the late antique period, and the way that the empire worked is there was the church and the state were completely intertwined, and the church was supposed to justify the state, and the state was supposed to protect and help organize the church. And part of that was that the emperor had some say in who got to be bishop and who got to be priests and stuff.
That really,
which is interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
That really connects it to, connects to the entire history of Christianity to that point where a bishop and a priest was not a political position, and they really had to be connected to the political authorities. That was something that they had always talked about, that there was an emperor and a bishop. It was an early form of the separation of church and states. Things are starting to change at this point because the state or the political entity is collapsing and there's nobody to fill the void.
Yeah. And I think that it goes to a lot of, you know, just broadly speaking, a lot of the interesting contradictions in Christianity in general and Catholicism and Orthodoxy in particular date back to the moment when, you know, this insurgent religion of crazy radicals suddenly became the official religion of the empire when Constantine converted. And just they spent then centuries trying to reconcile this religion, which had a lot of baked in suspicion of authority, yeah, with the fact that now they were supposed to be propping up authority.
Yeah, that was definitely a conflict area for a long time.
So I think this actually gets us to a little bit more context about what Gregory came into when he became Pope. And we talked a bit about the Italian Wars, but to give a little bit more context, that after everything sort of went downhill with the Byzantine Empire and the Persian Wars and the plague and then the rise of Islam in the East, the Byzantines couldn't really devote resources to Italy. And so to finish off the Ostrogoths and everything, they started using diplomacy to try and get different groups to fight each other. And one of the things they did was to get the Lombards to invade Italy. And as we've covered in my show in a little bit more depth, the Lombards kind of wiped the floor up with the Ostrogoths and then just kept going, which then left the Byzantine holdings in Italy facing this wave of Lombard invaders coming into Italy. And basically everything that wasn't super strongly fortified fell pretty quickly, which left the Byzantines with these sort of very tenuous holdings. There was sort of a five-city area in northern Italy around Ravenna, and then Rome, and this thin strip connecting them that was basically, if you look geographically on a topographical map, it was just this valley that went between the two ridges of the Apennines. So it was walled off by mountains. And then they had a bunch of fortified cities along the coast, and sort of southern Italy hadn't fallen yet because it was just too far away. But above, you know, north and south of this strip in central Italy, the Lombards had taken things over. And so the main thing that the papacy was facing at this point from a geopolitical standpoint was the fact that they were in the situation where they respected imperial law. They were loyal to the Byzantines, but Byzantine power was failing in the war against the Lombards. And so how does this come into play with his rule?
It's interesting in several ways. This is the point where the Pope Gregory had a lot of trouble with the Exarch of Ravenna. That was the Byzantine representative in Italy, the leader in Italy. And Gregory could not get any help from him. I don't remember his name. I don't even think it's really important.
Yeah,
Gregory could not get any help from him. Plus, this is where in the East, Constantinople was constantly fighting these issues with the Monophysites. That was a rival Christian theological position that was incredibly important in the East. There was the Council of Chalcedon in 451, where the Chalcedonians, they were the ones whose position was forwarded in this council. They were mostly in northern section of the Mediterranean and in the western section, where in the Middle right. East and in Egypt, this Monophysite position won out. And Constantinople was constantly trying to square the circle with Chalcedonianism and Monophysitism just so that they could live together and be one empire.
It's one of the weaknesses of basing your imperial ideology on religion.
Yeah.
You know, if some group decides that they disagree, they're willing to go to the wall for it, and all of a sudden your political empire is like, well, I mean, this isn't really the important thing. The important thing is fighting the Persians, but now all of a sudden we need to figure out how to live together.
And one of the issues was that the Chalcedonians in the West, they didn't care about the Monophysites, and they certainly didn't care to make any compromise with them. And right. the Monophysites living in Egypt particularly had zero interest in making any compromise with the Chalcedonians. So those right. battle lines were drawn. And so that's what made it so difficult for the emperors in Constantinople, because they had to constantly try to compromise. And they would.
Yeah, I mean, the emperor is going, like, I need these guys to fight the Persians. They're right on the border. And the Pope's going, border? What?
Yeah. So it was one compromise after another that the emperor would come up with. The Honoticon was one that caused a huge schism between Rome and Constantinople about 100 years previous to this. Then there's monophyletism, monoenergism. They come up with all these different, essentially, they're not even theological compromises. They're political compromises that nobody buys into.
Right. So, I mean, with all this stuff going on, that sort of creates a political tension between Gregory and the Byzantines.
Yeah, in short, that's where that gets that political controversy of the East gets injected into Italy, is that the official position of the Byzantine representatives in Ravenna is this monophyletism, that the popes are like, this is crazy. We're not going to compromise with this. And that was one of Gregory's jobs pre-pope, was to try and work with the Venetians and in Ravenna to make a compromise, and that he could not get a compromise out of them. That's one of his big failures, is that he could not get a compromise, or right. I don't even think they were really going for compromise. They were trying to just get the Byzantines to become Chalcedonians.
Yeah. It's interesting. I read a little bit that, sort of offhand in one of my sources, that while this is going on, the Lombards are coming in and they're Arians.
Yeah.
So you've got a mostly Catholic population, you've got Arian invaders, and then in the middle of all this, a couple of the bishops in northern Italy ended up converting to either Monophysitism or Monophyletism, which just throws all the cards up in the air for a little while.
Plus, Arianism was so different. I haven't found any great sources about their actual practice, but their general beliefs were quite divergent from mainstream Catholicism, Monophysitism or Chalcedonian. It doesn't either of them. It was very, very different from those two.
Yeah. Which at first, I think a lot of these German invaders thought that was going to be a strength, that they wanted to keep themselves somewhat aloof from the population in general and sort of really live as a military caste with completely different practices and lifestyles and everything. A lot of them set themselves up in like camps outside of cities for long-term periods. But in the end, that created problems being so separated from the population.
I also think when they started to marry in, and this is
definitely a
bird walk, but once they started marrying into the existing aristocracy, it was hard for them to maintain that separate culture when they're adopting so many different aspects of the local culture.
Yeah.
There just wasn't many of them.
Yeah, definitely. The result is actually pretty interesting. You know, Italy, obviously, Italian is one of the languages that's most close to Latin, but there actually are a ton of German loanwords and a lot of German influence on the legal code that then you didn't see in places like Provence in southern France, which had more of a had less influence from Germanic invaders to a certain extent. So that mixing is all fascinating.
Yeah, definitely.
So how did Gregory deal with the Lombards, since, you know, he couldn't necessarily rely on the Byzantines for help?
Well, that's the thing. All of those problems that Gregory was having with the Byzantines, and the Byzantines being either not able or not wanting to provide military support, Rome was under attack by these Lombards. He was the last man standing. There was no civil authority to take over. So that's where somebody like Gregory, he's coming in and he's organizing the militia. He's hiring generals. He is organizing defenses. He's making treaties with the Lombards. And maybe we won't call them treaties. Maybe it's just paying them off to not attack at that moment. I mean, it's much more ad hoc than treaties.
Because
technically he didn't have an authority to make a treaty.
Well, since he had no authority and civil society had fallen apart, forgive the obvious leading question, but so how did he pay for all this?
That's the Roman church had enormous amounts of productive land all throughout, from the time of Constantine. The secular government, the civil government, donated property to the church when rich aristocrats would donate property to the church. I mean, even common people would donate property and assets to the church. So all throughout the Italian peninsula into Italy and even in North Africa, the popes owned wealthy, productive lands that they could garner resources from.
Yeah. So, and you know, that land was really spread out. So it was very unlikely that any one invasion would knock it all out.
But then one of the problems is that at that time it was hard to communicate, and there really wasn't an organization set up to pull all those resources together and keep them moving smoothly, which was an issue.
Yeah. So one interesting point just before we move on is, it's interesting that the Roman, the political system lost its ability to compel people to pay their taxes and stuff, but people were voluntarily giving taxes essentially to the church. And so that became the new government. It's an interesting point.
We had talked about that in our episode with the warrior bishops.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where oftentimes these bishops, it wasn't that they usurped power. It's that the traditional civil power is gone. This happened a lot more in Northern Europe than it did in these areas, but there's nobody else there. The aristocrats moved there to their country manors and left the city, and there's nobody in the city to run the show anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. So what did, apart from paying the militia and hiring generals, what else did Gregory do with all this, these resources that he couldn't necessarily access because they were all over the place?
One of Gregory's main things, at least that are attributed to him, is that he put what they called a rector in charge of the papal properties. And these rectors answered directly to the Pope with nobody in between, or at least technically nobody in between. Mm-hmm. So that gave the Pope a lot more central control over all of these disparate properties and supposedly helped them run more efficiently. He also, there was, these were set up, these seven dioceses of Rome. They're called the suburban dioceses. They became throughout time the most important papal advisors, even to this day. They're the top advisors and they hold the top positions in the papal curia or central governing committee.
They're basically, they were given the title of, the people who were overseeing these dioceses were basically bishops, but they would come to be called cardinals, right?
Yes.
Much later.
This is, they are the core of the College of Cardinals, these seven bishops, and they were given the authority or more the responsibility to feed the poor and keep things running smoothly in their little diocese around Rome. They said it's at one point that the papal authority, the church, was feeding up to 30,000 people a day.
Oh, wow.
Now, that could be an expanded number, but It was still, they were the ones who were giving alms and keeping things going.
And that won a lot of that won a lot of respect from the population, I would assume.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's, obviously, if you're the person who's keeping the city relatively safe and you're feeding them, and the Byzantine emperor, whether he can do something or he can't do something, if he's not doing anything, his stock is getting lowered.
Yeah, definitely. So that sort of moved the traditional source of authority off of, the emperor delegates to the Pope, but now it's just, we just like the Pope because he's feeding us and the emperor's not really doing anything.
And I would just mention that if you're looking at that, what Gregory did was set up the medieval age of the papacy, getting the College of Cardinals going. That's a huge piece of the pie.
Yeah, definitely. So just to round the story off before we start digging in a little deeper, he eventually died, obviously. Can you just run through a little bit about his death?
Traditionally, he died in 590 from a series of illnesses, gout, everything that basically all the contemporary records and contemporary writers at the time attributed it to his extreme asceticism. And one way or the other, he was old and he was going to die.
Sure.
But he had a big legacy attached to him post-mortem.
Right. Some of which is we modern historians agree with, and some of which they don't. So let's get into that.
Hello, everybody. Very quickly, as I said at the opening, this is a very long episode, and I know some of you don't like super long episodes, so this seems like a good point to break. This is going to be our intermission for this episode rather than posting two episodes. So if you have anything you need to go do, pause it here and go do that. Otherwise, please enjoy some restful music while we have our intermission. Thank you very much.
As I said at the start, Gregory is one of only two popes known as the Great. And we're definitely going to talk about how we feel about that label, but let's run through some of the achievements that are attributed to him. Let's sort of go through this sort of category by category. I think one of the big things people know him for is in the arts, but maybe that's not necessarily accurate. What do you have on that?
One really big thing that's attached to Gregory is the Gregorian chant, which most people are probably familiar with. he probably had next to nothing to do with that. There was a form of, it was called Roman chant, but everywhere had a specific singing style. The Byzantines had a singing style. The Middle East had a singing style. Spain had a singing style.
Sure.
Even Milan had a particular style of singing, which you'd probably, I can't tell the difference between a lot of them. They sound very similar. But the Gregorian chant was a, it was a standardization of a chanting style. I did an episode on this if people really want the nitty gritty of the Gregorian chant. But basically there was no, at least in Western Europe, there was no way to write down how something is sung, like the melody of it.
Right.
And about 200-ish years after Gregory, a system was developed of at least getting the bare bones of how to sing.
Right.
So you could write that down and transfer it. And the person who invented that attributed it to Gregory without any really good reason to say why to attribute it to Gregory.
So that was like the 700s. There was kind of a lot of that going around in the church, I have to say, at that point. Between then and around 1000, there was the church is sort of notorious for well-intentioned or otherwise forgeries.
Created up in Frankish lands.
Yeah.
And they put a better stamp, a better spin on it. Let's call it Gregorian. He was great. Sure. Let's go with it.
So are there any other artistic works that are sort of worthy achievements from Gregory's time that are worthy of note, or is that the only one that people think of?
Those were the big ones that I know of. I don't think I read anything specific about anything such as like iconography or painting or anything like that.
So theologically, Gregory is one of the powerhouses of the early church, I'd say, or the medieval church. He's one of the first popes for whom we have a real body of work that survives. By my count, we have 4 major works, a large number of sermons, and over 800 letters. Amongst the major works is, and I should say that that's not that I went through the papal library and counted, that's from my sources. But amongst the major works is a popular Life of Saint Benedict, something that likely started building the reputation of Benedict's order in Rome, which would have importance later on, as we talked about in my last episode. But I think more importantly for our purposes going forward, there was the Book of Pastoral Rule. Can you tell us anything about that?
That was one of the books that he wrote that really had a long-lasting influence, and that was a book detailing how bishops and priests should live and how they should basically do their job. It was a job manual for bishops. It had a lot of popularity. It was translated into it was actually translated into Greek and used widely in the Greek East. It was adopted in Spain. Much later, Alfred the Great had the book translated into Anglo-Saxon.
Oh, yeah.
So it had a lot of cachet throughout the whole that whole early medieval time.
Are there any interesting specific takeaways that you know off the top of your head? I'll probably get into this in a later episode, but any specific rules that would be important?
One that's interesting is that he enforced strict celibacy amongst the clergy, which was, the West was always much more, the rule was clerical celibacy, but it wasn't very strictly enforced. There were bishops, and I mean, obviously Gregory had a great-great-grandfather.
Yeah, right.
Maybe there was a couple more greats in there, but who was a pope. So obviously he had children and they were all legitimate. The Greek East and the Middle East was much more comfortable with married pope or married clergy. They were all starting to get away from married bishops at this point, but married priests were still very common at that point. So he's setting up the rule of clerical celibacy right there. That was one of the ones that just struck out to me, but there's the books are super long. They're pretty easily accessible on the internet,
right, though.
If somebody's dying to dig into that.
Up until I started getting into this specifically, I would always get confused because there's two popes that are famous for doing a lot of reforms, both named Gregory. So I was never sure who to attribute the celibacy thing to. But I think it's worth saying that his enthusiasm for monasticism probably had a pretty big role in how he fell down on some of these directives for the priests and the bishops. It's sort of like he took the directives that he wanted for monks and said, you should be a monk, even though you're living amongst the people and leading them, kind of thing.
Yeah, and that's another part of his monasticism was that Gregory, I'm not exactly sure if it's in this Book of Pastoral Care, but Gregory was one of the first popes to start separating the monastics from the local bishops. At before that point, monasteries answered to whatever episcopal see they were in. So the bishop was always their boss. Gregory started giving them more independence where they didn't necessarily answer to the bishop of the geography their monastery was in.
Interesting.
Located in.
Yeah, that's interesting. I had assumed that that was always the case. But okay, that's good to know. So were there any other theological works that were worthy of note?
There's a few that are attributed to Gregory, but I don't necessarily know how much Gregory was directly involved with them. He may have been, but this may also be things that were attributed to him later.
Sure.
One is that he organized and reorganized the Roman liturgy or mass. I think they call it the pre-Tridentine mass. The Tridentine mass was the one used, I believe, 1400s-1500s-ish. It was reorganized. And it was used pretty much until Vatican II. So that,
okay, yeah.
And there was a form of the Tridentine Mass, which was used well before that into this time. I think they said that Gregory moved a piece here and moved a piece of it to over here, like where they say the Our Father, where they say this part. It's possible that he did that, and he probably would have had the authority and the respect to do something like that. But I feel that changes like that are more evolutionary than revolutionary. That's something like a liturgy like that's a very conservative document.
Yeah, yeah.
One other one that's interesting is there's something called the Liturgy of the Pre-Sanctified Gifts that supposedly Gregory wrote when he was in Constantinople. And that's something that's actually used in Eastern churches to this day.
Oh, that's interesting.
Which is not used very often in the Roman Catholic. It's a very minor part of it, but it's of their practice, but it's a major part of Eastern practice.
Huh, that's interesting. Okay, and then I guess one of the other big things that he's known for is missionary work. Do you have, there's some key stories that are associated with Gregory about this.
The first one that we spoke about a little earlier was that the Visigoths in Spain, their king Recared, converted from Arianism to Catholicism, and that it was really Gregory's fault, or his at least he was the one who got the king to convert. I think that's probably. There was a lot of other pressures on a Visigothic king to convert. So maybe there was a little tipping point there, but because Gregory was so great. But I think that that one's a little less clear. The big one is that Gregory is given credit for re-Christianizing Britain.
Right.
When the Anglo-Saxons invaded in the mid-400s, early to mid-400s, the traditional telling is that the whole island became pagan again, and it wasn't until the mid-500s with Gregory, who sent a big missionary expedition under Augustine of Canterbury. He wasn't Augustine of Canterbury yet.
Right.
And the story is that in Rome, Gregory was in the slave market and there was these blonde haired, blue eyed children. And he said something like, "You call them angels, but I call them angels," or something like that.
Yeah.
It's probably not true. What they think that might be more likely to be true is that there were Anglo-Saxon slaves and that the church was going through these slave markets, taking the children out of the slave markets, raising them Christian to become a core of missionaries that they would send later on.
That's interesting, yeah.
Gregory did send 40 missionaries to Britain, but by that point, the kings in Anglo-Saxon England were much more willing to listen to Christianity. That was really the thing that they needed to do to plug themselves into continental trade and continental relations, is that they needed to be Christian.
Right. You know, for economic reasons, if for none other.
Then you also had the Irish monks who were going into England at that time, who were probably doing a lot of the legwork. We'll see. That's another point that'll come up in later medieval history, is the conflict between the Anglo-Saxon church and the Irish church over a whole raft of practical Christian issues.
Yeah, we talked about that a bit in the last episode. You know, the Celtic Christianity is sort of the inaccurate catch-all term, and then an Irish monasticism was a huge influence up there, and it fit really well into the social order in Ireland and Scotland. And then you had the missionaries who were being sent by Gregory moving up from the south, and the fault lines built up in sort of Northumbria and that kind of area.
I even think that in England, it's much more accurate to say that it was more of a situation like in Spain, where you have a ruling elite.
Yeah.
And like the Christianity was still there. It wasn't well organized as was, because Christianity was still pretty light on the ground, even amongst the native populations, the holdovers from the Roman Empire. That was not one of the densest Christian populations.
Yeah, and it's plausible that the leaders, the people who would have been the natural leaders of the Christian society in the British Isles, sort of fled. They were the ones who had the money to mm-hmm. leave, and all urban life collapsed, so there wasn't a natural way to organize them. But at the same time, it's kind of, we know now that there wasn't some kind of genocide.
Yeah.
the lower classes were definitely British, even after the Anglo-Saxons took over. But speaking of the economy and slavery, one of the big ongoing debates about Gregory has revolved around his relationship with the Jews. And I think this actually gets into the issue of these massive slave markets in Italy. It's just an interesting bit of background to give before we get into the Jewish issue. Trade in the Mediterranean had, and you know, the whole former Roman world had kind of collapsed. And one of the few commodities that was still moving was actually slaves, which gets into some of the background for what we're about to talk about here. There, you know, Jews in medieval society, it's going to be a whole episode at some point in the future, but for now, we actually have a lot of material about Gregory and the Jewish communities in Italy, and it turns out that they were actually some large and prosperous Jewish communities, which Christian doctrine was struggling to figure out how to deal with. Even, you know, centuries beforehand, there had been this ongoing struggle to figure out how to relate to the Jews, because they weren't pagans, but they were this competing ideology, essentially, that rejected Christianity very explicitly by this point. One of the big guiding lights theologically had been St. Augustine's doctrine of the witness people, which, again, we're going to go into a lot more detail, but basically St. Augustine said that it was important that the Jews survive so that they could witness how right Christianity was, and that, you know, so we couldn't kill or forcibly convert the Jews. I'm Jewish. they couldn't kill or forcibly convert the Jews, but they also shouldn't be nice to them in any way. They just had to be there as sort of a token enemy of Christianity to observe the glorious success of Christianity up to the end. So in this context, I mean, that's a pretty, you know, it's nice that he wasn't saying to wipe them out, but that's a pretty rough theology, to be honest. And that was sort of the main doctrine, even of Roman legal tradition, up to Gregory's time. So what can we say about Gregory's record here?
I think it's important to keep in mind that later ideas on anti-Semitism get kind of built on to the foundation of this point. Someone like Augustine and these earlier writers who were writing polemics against the Jews, you have to remember it's not until maybe the 500-600s where clear lines are being drawn between what's a Jew and what's a Christian. There's still Christians at this point who are celebrating the Easter feast on the 14th or 15th of Nisan.
Right. Passover.
Yeah, on Passover. So whether it's a Tuesday or a Wednesday or whatever, that's when they're celebrating Easter. And the bishops are having a big fit about that. There's Christians who are going to synagogue on Saturday and then going to church on Sunday because there's, like you said, they're seeing that there's some sort of mojo that the Jews have, and there's that they're seeing that there's a, they have something going on religiously. So the lines are not clearly, I mean, even with the pagan religions, the popes in the 500s are having a fit because at the end of the Easter celebration, the people are going out to take a look at the rising sun and doing like Sol Invictus stuff.
Yeah.
There's the lines are still really blurred. They're getting less blurred at this time. Like what we would really call like real anti-Semitism is more of a function of like the 10th and 11th century, where these are the Jews, they're a different religion. We know they're a separate religion. Like everybody's on the same page that we're all separate religions and we're going to kill them specifically for that.
Right.
That's
later.
Yeah. That's coming down the line.
Yeah. One of the big things that I'm going to be talking about later, but there's been a very, since the Holocaust, obviously, there's been this attempt to understand the origins of anti-Semitism, and that leads to some errors in terms of looking at history in terms of leading inevitably towards the Holocaust, which, you know, it's not like St. Augustine, when he was writing about the witness people doctrine, he was going, I'm planting the seeds that are going to lead to the gas chambers.
Yeah.
It was a series of steps taken for purposes that were very local and of their time and place. And certainly they built on each other over time, but, you know, we're, as human beings, we have a very limited ability to think in millennial terms, you know, thousands of years down the line. So, and that's really what we're talking about, things that these little doctrinal decisions that built on each other over the course of tens of centuries. But with that said, you know, and that background understood. Sorry?
Back to Gregory.
Back to Gregory. What was his relationship with the Jews? Because it's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, it's interesting. Gregory he was certainly no fan of Jews, and he didn't want people who were already Christian becoming Jews. But he also, it was not uncommon in certain places for synagogues to be attacked. And he was completely against that. If a synagogue was attacked, he's on record saying that the people needed recompense for their damaged property. I think he didn't want Jews getting special treatment, but he wanted them being treated with, he said that they should be treated within the law. There's just a short quote. He said, this is Gregory, just as no freedom may be granted to the Jews and their communities to exceed the limits legally set for them, so they should in no way suffer through a violation of their rights. That was a common phrasing that would be used by popes later whenever they wrote about or wrote official doctrines about the Jews.
Yeah, my reading is that that's more or less the official doctrine of the church in general, mm-hmm. Excepting a couple crazy priests out in the countryside who weren't really properly educated, and then whatever it was that happened in Spain, which we'll talk about eventually,
yeah,
with the Inquisition there. But the main thrust of the church was, we follow Roman law, and Roman law says create the special place, the special basket for the Jews to sit in, and that's where they're supposed to sit, and you don't mess with that basket, but they also don't get out of that basket.
Gregory, he was totally against using physical means to convert Jews to Christianity. That was happening at that point in certain areas where you know, people would literally have their arms twisted to convert to Christianity. But he was not against using financial or tax breaks or that sort of thing to get people to convert, which was really not outside of the norm of how the Abrahamic religions would operate in the era, you know, in the Middle East, medieval area. I mean, that was part of the Dhimmi amongst Islam. It was just, there was a financial benefit to join Islam.
Right.
So Gregory didn't have a problem with that.
What's interesting in one of my sources, which is Kevin Madigan, the medieval.
Oh, that's a great book.
Yeah, it is. Medieval Christianity and New History. It's one of my main sources. It's actually got an audiobook version for anyone who wants to go through that. It's great. One of the things he says is that despite all the things that Gregory said about sort of keeping the Jews in their basket and not letting them get out, is that he actually, of all the popes, possibly went more out of his way than anyone else to actually give Jews special protection and benefits, possibly beyond what was required by Roman law, going so far as to actually, you know, pick fights with Byzantine emissaries to protect Jewish interests. He doesn't say anything about this, but one of the things I wonder about is because the Jews were such an important part of the economic community of Italy at the time, and because Italy was so economically moribund, whether that wasn't, you know, at least somewhat a, you know, rational policy decision, essentially, to be like, we, at least someone's trading. We need to protect these people.
Gregory, one thing that he did do was that he said that Jews who owned Christian slaves could not own Christian slaves, that they would lose that property.
Right.
So I guess you could call that a form of anti-Semitism, that they weren't, that they were being denied a property right, but then they was freeing slaves. So you kind of like, you know, it's hard to take a strong moral take on that.
Yeah. And that was a big thing throughout. It wasn't just something that the church was imposing on Jews at that point either. They were coming, it wasn't as strong a doctrine as that it would be later, but the church gradually came down on the concept of owning Christian slaves. It was not generally acceptable. I think at this point it was more acceptable, especially given the economic importance of the slave trade in Italy, but it was certainly something that the church kind of looked askance on when, like, the Catholic Franks would raid an area and take mm-hmm. Catholic slaves. They're like, are you serious?
And I'm sure you'll get into this later. Slavery had in large part gone away as an institution in the medieval period. It really was really in the early modern period. It was in the uptake. I read a book, Those Terrible Middle Ages, by French Perrault, yeah. I think her name is. And she wrote that mm-hmm. it was with the African slave trade and the enslavement of native people throughout the colonialized areas that slavery really skyrocketed.
Yeah, there's some low-key debate about this, but basically the consensus is roughly that in most places in Europe, there had been these big slave plantations in the Roman world, and the numerous plagues that went through and the starvation and the social dislocation meant that there wasn't a new source of slaves coming in, really. And so you needed to work harder to protect those slaves. So the status of the slaves actually rose. They gained a lot of rights, a lot of protections. Although their status was frozen, manumitting them became nearly impossible, but their status rose. They became tied permanently to land. But then at the same time, as political rights for the population in general like went away in the face of all these attacks, the status of normal poor people, free persons, dropped. And serfdom in the Middle Ages essentially became this, and I'm going to get into this more in later episodes, it wasn't quite this simple, but you sort of mushed together poor farmers and slaves into the serf class. At the same time, in the early Middle Ages, slavery was still very much a thing, and the slave trade was very active. It's just that the economic collapse of the West meant that the slavery was all going in one direction, mm-hmm. and that was east. Europe was a source of slaves for the Avars, the Hungarians, the Saracens, the Vikings. They would capture these slaves and move them east. There were a couple really big routes. One of them was for the Vikings through the Baltic and then down to Byzantium that way. Byzantium and the Caliphate through Russia. And then the other big route was overland, sort of through Central Europe along the Danube and then overland through Kiev. And it's interesting, one of the main founding reasons for Kiev to exist was that it was a crossing point for a couple of these slave trading routes. And that's sort of a big part of behind its early prosperity. Same thing for a couple of the cities in England. The slaving in Ireland would then take people through England and off to the Baltic and stuff like that. So slavery was definitely still a thing. But it wasn't something that was practiced on local populations. Christian slaves were being taken by people in Europe. And I should say that as much as the church frowned on it, like the Franks were definitely taking slaves. They would just sell them on to Scandinavians who could get away with it, which is it says a lot about it's how the Vikings knew how to attack, that they were trading with the Scandinavians. So the Scandinavians were very aware of what the political situation was in Charlemagne's empire. Anyway, back to Gregory. I think we've run through, a lot of the stuff that people attribute to him and that people attribute to what makes him the great. And just to sort of put a bow on it, the standard story is that Gregory is sort of the origins of the imperial papacy, that he had a couple writings where he talked about how the Pope should be in control, that it should be the head of the church. He did a lot to gain the political goodwill of people, definitely in Rome, but then people, the word spread. So, all through Italy, people were moving their loyalty to the church, especially as bishops in other cities did similar things to the almsgiving that he did in Rome. And this sort of began the power base of the papacy that it would grow later on. What do we think about that sort of narrative?
I think looking backwards, it's very easily, we're very easily able to set that narrative. I think it was foisted upon Gregory. Previous to Gregory, the popes were in a brutal fight with Constantinople of who's going to be the theological boss of Christianity. Mm-hmm. Rome always, you have to look at this point, that's probably, we're getting into the low watermark of where Rome had theological power even in their own territory.
Right.
So the Rome is trying to fight to get that power back, plus the power that they felt that they had over the universal church, all of Christendom.
Right.
The temporal power is getting forced onto the Pope at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
So the popes are getting these two powers. They're becoming a power in the secular area, and they're fighting to get this power in the religious area. That's going to grow throughout the whole Middle Ages into the modern period. There's going to be stepping stones to developing those both of the powers. So we can, you know, I guess we can kind of see that the seeds were planted in this point, not necessarily with Gregory,
yeah,
but that the popes are going to get a unique position where they have a lot of civil power and they're going to have a lot of religious power.
Yeah. It's like you said, it's like seeds being planted. And sort of this ties back to the anti-Semitism discussion, really, because it's easy to impose this narrative backwards based on what we knew it was going to happen. And Gregory probably, despite he made some statements about how the Pope should be in control of everything, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I doubt that he was, when he appointed the cardinals to distribute alms to the poor people, he was thinking this is going to be the basis of the way the Pope is elected in a more streamlined fashion in several centuries.
Yeah. And I've always struggled with the question, was the medieval pope in the papal lands a theocrat? Was that a theocracy? And sometimes I'm like completely yes, and sometimes I'm completely no. And I think that that's the dichotomy. Yeah. The pope of the Middle Ages was two offices mashed together, yeah, that were separate, though. There was like a separation of church and state within one person.
Yeah, it's like they would take off hats and stuff and behave in completely different, yeah, manners. You know, the in some ways the church and the state were blended in that whole survival of the Kaiseropapism and sort of doctrine of the Davidic kingship, where the king is supposed to look after the moral health of the church and the church is supposed to be the spiritual guide of the people. That whole way of looking at things was definitely a thing in the Middle Ages, but it was also clear that what was needed to be a successful ruler in the Middle Ages was so different from what Christian doctrine was, that even when you had rulers who were also church officials, they would, you know, expound Christian doctrine that was so completely different from the way that they behaved as rulers. And it's easy to say, call that hypocrisy, but it's almost like they were just fulfilling different social functions, you know, taking off, yeah, one hat and putting another one on. And that may just be what was necessary at the time.
For everything, too, with the popes of wanting secular and for accumulating secular power, for quite a while after Gregory, a pope still needed the seal of approval of the Byzantine emperor.
Right.
That would get transferred over to the Holy Roman Emperor.
Yeah.
And that lasted for hundreds of years, that the Pope had to be officially stamped, would need the official stamp of approval of the Holy Roman Emperor for his religious authority.
Yeah.
And effectively for his secular authority as well.
Yeah, definitely. And that's going to be something that I'm going to be talking about. That process is going to be something I'm going to be addressing in the next couple of episodes, because you know, as you probably gathered from the title, The Tale of Two Gregories, the next thing I'm going to be talking about is Gregory the VII. And that leads right into the investiture controversy and everything around that. And the struggle over, you know, sort of the independence of the church versus the independence of the empire and secular rulers. This is why I needed to go back to Gregory the First.
And this is all things that are developing over the course of like a millennium.
Yeah. I mean, Gregory the Seventh, is, oh man, I completely forget when he ruled. Gregory the Seventh began his papacy in 1073. So we're talking like 500 years later.
Yeah.
It's not an inconsequential amount of time. The whole situation was very, very different in many ways. So I think that brings us, that sort of covers everything we definitely wanted to cover. Just like to thank you very much for coming on and helping us get through all this. This has been great.
Oh, thank you. I hope I didn't go off on tangents too much. It's just, it's so awesome. And there's so many things that all come together.
Definitely. I mean, that's why I needed to cover it. And these were, a lot of these were tangents that I've wanted to cover too. So where can people find out about your show?
You can find all of the social media and where to subscribe and iTunes and all that at my website, a2zhistorypage.com.
Great. Awesome. And of course, if you're listening to this show, you've heard me say it a billion times, but my website is WittenbergToWestphaliaPodcast.weebly.com. And again, you can get to the Facebook page and Twitter from there. You can email me. Please listen to all of our show, both of our shows, and review us on iTunes. And thanks everybody for listening. I should also thank the Blue Dot Sessions for the intermission music, and as always, Not a Surf for the intro and outro music.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.